Good morning, everyone, and welcome to What Clinicians Want to Know, Addressing Current Questions and Controversies in the Management of Chronic Myeloid Leukemia. I'm Dr. Michael Morrow, and I'll be moderating the meeting today. This is our faculty. I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Andreas Hochhaus from University Hospital Jena, and Doug Smith from the Kimmel Cancer Center at Johns Hopkins. We have some disclosures, as we should disclose. This is for Professor Hochhaus, for Dr. Smith, and for myself. And with regards to commercial support, the activity this morning is graciously brought to you by an educational grant from Novartis. Research to Practice CME Planning Committee and staff and reviewers have no relevant conflicts of interest to disclose. So we will have some non-FDA approved uses and some novel agents discussed, so please refer to the official prescribing information for the approved drugs and bear in mind that we have some non-FDA approved drugs as well. We're going to have three presentations with plenty of time for Q&A. Just to note that in order to make this meeting more relevant and to bring some questions to bear, a survey of 50 general medical oncologists was conducted over the last few weeks. Questions provided during that survey will be asked to the faculty as well as your questions, and the full survey results are on the iPad and available in the chat for viewing as well. So this is where we're headed today. Our first presentation will be on upfront therapy for CML by Professor Hochhaus. I'll speak on relapsed CML, including patients with the T315I mutation, and then Doug Smith will speak on tolerability and practical issues for our CML therapies commonly employed. So here's some of the data from the GMO survey, just so you know. Really just asked about the topics for future programs, sort of what's interesting or what's needed to know in CML. So our top answer was comparison to asciminib to other therapies as frontline therapy, very timely. And as well others, as you can see, frontline choices in general, what to do for patients with the T315I mutation, similarities or differences between our ATP competitive frontline agents and the and so on. So I think we're going to cover those, and please ask questions as you need to. So let me turn things over to Professor Hochhaus to speak on upfront therapy. Professor Hochhaus.
Yeah, Mike, thank you very much for the introduction. Dear colleagues, I want to talk about the upfront therapy for CML from my perspective, but also from the perspective of the recommendation panels, NCCN and ELN. When we consider our own studies of the last 12 years, this was the TIGER study here in Germany with the basis on nilotinib primary treatment in CML. We see now an 8-year survival of 95%. This was reported last year at the EHA and the ASH meetings. That's very close to the normal survival of the population. Therefore, I think we need alternative and additional goals of therapy to fine-tune the treatment. Lack of progression, quality of life, tolerability, absence of long-term side effects, and of course, the achievement and the option for treatment-free remission. And when we look at the evolution of first-line therapies, we have now, with the recent registration of asciminib by the FDA, we have now 5 drugs available, starting from imatinib over the second generation, nilotinib, dasatinib, bosutinib, now to asciminib. Our milestones have changed. We started 24 years ago with the achievement of complete cytogenetic remission. In the IRIS trial, we defined MMR, and now, of course, DMR is our main goal of treatment because we want to achieve treatment-free remission for our patients and for a larger cohort of patients to induce this option. But quality of life plays now a major role, knowing all the side effects from the previous drugs, and we want to avoid such side effects, also the low-grade side effects which come day by day to improve quality of life. And all this together is now important for the choice of the first-line treatment. For second and later lines of therapy, of course, the major point is to prevent disease progression, but of course in the context of quality of life for our patients. So when we now look at the chance to achieve treatment-free remission, it's well known that it's much better with the second-generation drugs compared to imatinib. Here's the example of the NSAID trial. The achievement of the definitions for treatment-free remission recommendations, that means deep molecular response for at least a year, and this is advantageous for nilotinib over imatinib. The biochemical background of our tyrosine kinase inhibitors is very different. Seeing here on the dendrograms, you see all these red bubbles, which are inhibitions of kinase, of different kinases. These multi-kinase inhibitors may have an advantage when it comes to BCR-ABL-independent resistance. But of course, this is a background for side effects as well. Therefore, we need to balance the choice of the treatment according to the need. What is the driving force in this CML patient? And in first-line patients, it's, of course, BCR-ABL in most, if not all, patients in the contrast to a multi-kinase inhibition for patients who have alternative pathways activated. And asciminib is the most stringent BCR-ABL inhibitor. It inhibits only BCR-ABL, but not many other kinases. So, but as I mentioned, the multi-kinase inhibition may be the background for side effects. Here in the case of nilotinib, you see that there is a cumulative risk for cardiovascular side effects over time. That means when you when your choice is nilotinib or dasatinib over imatinib as a first-line therapy to achieve TFR, and if this TFR is not achieved, I would recommend personally to change the therapy after 5 years to have a second chance for TFR, but also to avoid cumulative side effects. The same is the case for dasatinib, but of course not with with cardiovascular side effects, but with pleural effusions. In order to avoid this, we did the DASA-HIT trial, and the DASA-HIT was a trial comparing 7 days of dasatinib versus 5 days. And as you see here, we have lack of inferiority. That means the same MMR rate, but halving the risk for pleural effusions. Therefore, my personal recommendation is in first-line therapy to use, when dasatinib is the drug of choice, to use a 5-day schedule over the 7-day schedule. So we have an evolution of the prognostic factors. Now we use the ELTS score, which consists of age, spleen size, blasts, and platelets. And in addition, we have biological factors. And one of them, one very important, is additional chromosomal aberrations of high risk. We defined them as trisomy 8, second Philadelphia, derivative 3, minus 7, ISO 17, and so on. They are very well defined, and you see that the prognosis of these patients is disadvantageous compared to the regular 922 translocation. And in addition, we have now molecular aberrations, and these molecular aberrations are manifold. You have A6L1 as the most important one, also at baseline. And what we don't know currently is which drug triggers and or is associated with a reduced prognosis in these patients. Do we need multi-kinase inhibitors? Do we need combinations? What about asciminib? This will be addressed during the meeting, but when we look at these first-line options here, we have, of course, to avoid the side effects, the option to consider the concerns and the comorbidities, but also to adapt the doses, which has been done for all these drugs. Come back to asciminib. Asciminib is a specific BCR-ABL inhibitor with a different mode of action. That means we inhibit the myristoyl pocket, which is open in case of BCR-ABL, in contrast to wild-type ABL. And the first-line study was designed in a way that prior to randomizations, patients and doctors were discussing the standard of care for this individual patient, either imatinib or a second-generation drug. And there was a specific randomization, asciminib against imatinib and asciminib against second-generation drugs. The major endpoint was the comparison of MMR at week 48 between asciminib and all investigator-selected TKIs. And the 48-week endpoint is shown here, 67.7 versus 49.0%. And so, remarkably, you see a steep increase of MMR very early after 12 weeks of therapy. All the other molecular endpoints are advantageous for asciminib as well. Here, early molecular response and also the deep molecular responses. The second primary endpoint was the comparison of asciminib versus imatinib. And here, the difference is even bigger, 69 versus 40% MMR rate after 48 weeks. And also, the other parameters show an advantage for asciminib over imatinib. The favorable safety and tolerability profile is demonstrated here with the patients which discontinued treatment, and you see an advantage of asciminib over imatinib and also second-generation drugs. And if you look at the different strata here, we see a favorable response for asciminib in all ELTS strata in both genders and also in all age categories. So side effects are important, and I selected a few side effects here. You see a clear advantage for asciminib over imatinib and second generation drugs in the frequency of side effects. The only exception is the lipase increase. Lipase increase is observed in all of these drugs. I'm not sure what would happen in the normal population if we did a lipase screening in normal people. I would expect the same numbers here. That means it's the current question: is lipase really important when it's not associated with pancreatitis? Should we consider this in our choice? Probably not, but we need to explain this a little bit more in detail. With this data in the background, NCCN recommended asciminib for low-risk, intermediate-risk, and high-risk patients as a choice for first-line therapy. So this data was confirmed by our Australian colleagues in the ASCENT trial, will be reported here as well as an update, but this is the data here which has been published in Blood very recently. Asciminib, the start of asciminib was the development of combination therapies, because we had these two different binding sites available, and therefore we started in Germany years ago a frontline treatment combining asciminib with the ATP competitors, and we have seen 38% MR4 rate after 12 months, but also side effects, because when you combine two drugs, the result cannot be better than one of the drugs alone. Therefore, the major advantage of asciminib to improve tolerability cannot be achieved with this combination therapies. But as I mentioned, it's very important to demonstrate the tolerability of asciminib, and therefore a second first-line study was designed and was running, the Ask for Start study, closed for recruitment now, comparing asciminib with nilotinib, but with the primary objective to show time to treatment discontinuation. The analysis of the study is currently ongoing, and I'm looking forward to this data to demonstrate the second important part of the asciminib development, to demonstrate the improvement of quality of life. I just want to mention that the impact of cancer gene variants on the outcome will be discussed during the meeting here in the asciminib monotherapy patient from our colleagues from Australia, and also in the combination treatment in the fascination trial by Thomas Ernst because we have not seen a disadvantage of asciminib when we use it in combination in the case of ASXL1 mutations. And this will be, I think, a very interesting point for the future discussion on the use of asciminib in first-line therapy in CML. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andreas. That was terrific. please bring any of your questions through the iPad forward. I think someone's going to collate them. But we have some questions from our general audience, and I think we may have touched on these. But the first question is quite simple, but I'm not sure if we touched on it, and that's about monitoring. Dr. Smith, Dr. Horkas, maybe you both can comment on this. About, do we have any difference in our monitoring schedules nowadays?
Any difference?
Compared to historically?
No, we designed in the IRIS trial, we started with a 3-monthly monitoring, and this was quite successful for our decision points. And I think we should start with a 3-monthly monitoring in the patient. As soon as we achieve a deep molecular response, it's important to continue this to demonstrate the ongoing deep molecular response to have the chance for discontinuation after 2 years. But then, of course, we change the monitoring. We do it more frequently to detect an increase of BCR-ABL. But then in the third step, when we have always zero in a patient in TFR, I think after 2 or 3 years, we could relax a little bit.
Yeah, patients are pretty anxious, and so are physicians. So you get a lot of patients that will be getting monitored almost monthly when they're first diagnosed. The challenge with that is we really don't know what to do with the numbers.
Yes.
We have a pretty good sense of what to do at 3 months. You know, we're shooting for a goal of 10% or around 10% or less by PCR. That gives you a good sense of the patient's responding early. But we don't know what to do with 35% at 1 month. And we don't know what to do with some of these other numbers. So I really encourage my referring physicians to try to stick to 3 months early on. Look for that opportunity in the future when you get really deep confirmed, undetectable, or deep molecular responses. Then you can back off a little bit to make it a little simpler for the patients.
In my experience, I think monitoring, PCR monitoring, is a very good option to improve compliance. Because when patients see their responses, they are more compliant than when they are lost in space.
Good feedback. Yeah. I think probably message one is we know that gathering the data is the most important. So clearly, especially earlier on, because we have new choices, we have not just better frontline choices, but the ability to switch. And Dr. Smith, excellent point about when to switch. It may be an individualized decision, and I think those guidelines can be fine-tuned. Lastly, I think on the back end, for the patients in TFR, I agree, at some point we may be able to have a lesser monitoring schedule over time as we gain more confidence. But so good. So now we have a bit of a case here, a patient who's 12 months on frontline imatinib with no evidence of progression, but transcripts, perhaps as you were alluding to, Doug, you know, that their transcript decision decreasing from 21% at 3 months to 4% at 12 months. So I view this as a case where we might have, number one, seen that at the 3-month response might not have been as expected, but then with a bit of patience, we see the patient has indeed improved, but perhaps not optimally. So what do you think?
There might have been a reason to treat this patient with imatinib and not with a second-generation drug, and I don't know that. When I see such a patient after 12 months, it was not my patient, obviously, and I see this patient, I would change treatment because I never treat a patient with imatinib first line except very, very rare cases. But I would change treatment here because this patient needs the option for TFR, and with this 3% after 12 months, it's not a risk, it's not a disease risk, but it's a major risk to not achieve TFR.
This case is actually really applicable in the U.S. because there is a lot of pressure to use imatinib frontline therapy based on its generic status. Now, that's changing. We know that there are additional drugs now becoming generic and available, so we will have second gens to look at as frontline therapy. But we do see cases like this, and I agree completely that a year with not achieving a complete cytogenetic remission by the 3% or whatever PCR,
yeah,
this is somebody that should be on a second generation at this point.
So. We actually got a question from the Zoom chat, and it may apply here. So it's saying, is it fair to group all the second generation TKIs together? Because this may be a case where we're thinking about a switch, and
yeah,
and they're different with regards to, in many ways. What, any comments on that?
I have an additional point here. The additional point is, of course, to consider the side effects. If a patient does not achieve a good response on imatinib, when you ask him in more detail, he will mention daily problems. Yeah, the puffy eyes, the muscle cramps, the gastrointestinal problems, which was not relevant for us 20 years ago when imatinib was registered because it was the only drug. Now we have the choices, and why not use the choices to improve the side effect profile?
Yeah, the Mike Morrow's law of Mike Morrow is that intolerance is directly and proportionally related to the number of choices you have,
yeah,
as far as drugs. And so side effect profile is certainly important. We'll talk about this at the last lecture this morning, a little bit about this is how we're going to personalize these TKIs, six of them available to us, five up front. Side effect profile is going to be one of the ways that we're able to do that.
I think that's a perfect segue. Maybe we'll kind of move on to some of the other questions. So so what factors are we considering when we're determining our upfront choice, especially in light of new choices available? Do we have a preferred? And if so, which one? Don't feel obligated to put your finger on one, but let's talk about this.
No, my answer is quite clear. If a study is available, I choose the study and participate in the study. And that's what I did in the last 20 years, always. Therefore, I didn't have this question in my own practice. But of course, comorbidities are important. If a patient has a vascular problem, I think nilotinib should be excluded as a first-line therapy. If he has a lung problem, dasatinib should be excluded. But I have more and more good experience in older patients with second-generation drugs. It's not forbidden for older patients. You could, now we have data on lower dose of dasatinib, which is feasible also in older patients. That means imatinib with this low-grade daily side effects is for me not a drug of choice anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I know you probably couldn't include everything, but you know, if we drill down to the asciminib frontline data, there was no real issue with elderly patients, and I think maybe more elderly patients went up in the imatinib strata comparatively, but they did quite well. So I think that's really reassuring that our newer drugs are actually less side effects and maybe quite tolerable in that population too.
Michael, in your practice, I want to ask you about your practice. You know, as far as there are pressures for generic drugs up front, and imatinib is still in play for a lot of U.S. clinicians, how are you approaching first and seconds?
I can use the same cop-out answer, I think, as Andreas. I try to put patients in trials, which obviates the need for making a decision. But the truth is, I feel that there are pressures. There are different opinions, clearly, on how to weigh the costs, the benefits. But I think the data speaks for itself. And you know, when you're speaking to a patient, you have to advocate for them. So I generally choose what the science and the studies tell us, and try to navigate the payer's system aggressively for the sake of our patients. It's tough.
Yeah.
So I think we've sort of partially answered this about asciminib differentiating itself from other TKIs. I think we sort of heard a sentiment about using it up front. We saw good data. So sort of a big question on the table. You know, we have approval. What do we think about it as the upfront choice?
When asciminib is approved in Europe as well?
Let's say it is.
Yeah, of course, asciminib with this data.
Yeah.
And you will see,
Follow the science.
During the meeting. I mean, I didn't mention this. You will see the 96-week data during the meeting, and it will support this.
I think that's a very fair answer. So we're hopeful that other patients will gain access to it, and we'll all become familiar with it.
It's hard to look at the success of the drug and offset by a favorable toxicity profile. It's the combination of both that really make it very promising up front for a lot of us.
Yeah.
I think my only, it's not a concern, but it's a scientific question. My only question is the patient who have some evolution of CML already with A6L1 or with the other bypassing pathways, do we need more than just a BCR-ABL inhibitor? I think that's my only concern, but this takes us busy in the next years for new studies.
Yeah. I know you touched on the combinations with fascination.
Yeah.
So maybe this third question, you guys can both comment on the combinations. Where are we? And certainly not ready for prime time yet, and maybe has some pluses and minuses.
We have good experience with the combinations from the phase one. In the phase one, lots of combinations were tested, but always the full dose of an ATP competitor with a lower dose of asciminib. I would do it in the contrary now with all this experience, to use 80 milligrams of asciminib combined with a lower dose of an ATP competitor. But that's a scientific question that's not approved, not at all, and therefore I think we need to address this in future trials.
I want to take a different spin on the asciminib upfront question and ask you specifically.
Mm.
We talk about sequencing drugs, and we talk about what do we do next. Now, I realize this really effective drug up front, but we're going to, if history tells us anything, we're going to have resistance develop over time with all of these agents. The question is, how are we going to start to think about sequencing now if we're already initiating up front with maybe arguably the most effective drug?
To address this mechanistically, it's quite easy. On asciminib, you may see a few patients with myristoyl site mutations over time. And these patients are ideal patients for an ATP competitive drug. Therefore, I think is not to go back, it's just to use all the panel you have available for sequencing. It's not a stepwise approach starting from imatinib to asciminib. You can rotate the drugs according to the biology of this individual patient. And when the patient develops a mutation which is sensitive to the alternative drug, then of course you should use it.
And historically we've seen mutational-based resistance may be more a known entity and maybe more responsive. So that's encouraging. So I think we want to pluck one question from this group here because we're getting a little bit close on time. Question number two here about recommendations for the difficult patient with thrombocytopenia or perhaps heart failure. So these are some of the more troubling medical morbidities we may see. I think myelosuppression is probably one of the biggest challenges. Do we have any thoughts on our initial therapy in that setting? Thank you, Doug.
Myelosuppression is tricky because I think it is a class effect for a lot of them. It's hard for me. I try different drugs to see if there's a little bit less. I don't have a true sense of one second generation being better than another with thrombocytopenia, for example, which is a big challenge, I think, for 15 to 20% of patients started on TKIs. It's meaningful. Asciminib, maybe a little bit less, we'll see.
Is this drug related or is this biology of the CML? Yeah. I think when you have a patient with a very big spleen and maybe a minor degree of fibrosis as well, then you can expect cytopenias in the early phase with all the drugs.
Yeah.
And you should overcome this, reducing the spleen size, then you will overcome this. And therefore, I think this notion that cytopenias in the first 6 months are adverse events is not correct, not entirely correct. Officially in the studies, yes. But it's biology of the CML, and it should be overcome.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a disease phenomenon. And I was encouraged that the frontline data for asciminib was a little less thrombocytopenia and myelosuppression than maybe in later line patients or comparatively.
Yeah, but in ASCEMBL we have seen a little bit more in third line than with bosutinib, but this is part of the efficacy. If a drug is very efficacious and reduces the leukemic clone very fast, then you see, of course, transient cytopenias until the recovery of normal hematopoiesis.
Yeah. There's one other question from the Zoom. I'm going to take it. It's thoughts on the new FDA approval of the reformulation of nilotinib that doesn't require fasting, and thoughts on the potential safety related to QTC and CV events. So we're talking about Danzatin, which was just approved as a reformulation of nilotinib, which now allows for a slightly different milligram dosing and patients not needing to fast, which I think is a nice advance. I think preliminarily we know that we may be avoiding excess drug exposure, which may be disadvantageous and could be related to QT prolongation. I think we are would eagerly await more data on other safety mitigation. Do you guys have any other comments about that?
I think QTC prolongation is not that risky anymore as it was in the beginning when nilotinib received this black box warning. But it's important when we consider combination of drugs which prolong QTC. I think that's still very important to consider this with all TKIs. This should be checked initially, and we can change the additional drugs here.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So maybe in the interest of time, we'll move on. So I'll talk to you a bit now on some of the issues with relapsed CML, including patients with a T315I. So as alluded to, you know, our NCCN guidelines in the U.S. Are very good and give us direction. This traffic light analogy, I think, is very handy. We mentioned earlier about, you know, how do we make decisions about when is a therapy failing a patient? At what point do we feel like it's time for a change? Clearly, patients who, you know, by 6 months haven't achieved any sense of molecular response, we need to think about drug interactions and adherence as probably question number one. Mutation analysis, I think, has historically been an important issue. I think currently it's almost now almost a bit more of an important issue because we have different mutations to assay for with myristoyl pocket active agents and different patterns of resistance. There are warning categories. We don't want to be premature and switch patients who perhaps are between, you know, at 3 months and may have some slow transcript kinetics. There are patients who later on may have persistence of transcripts in orange, where we have the same questions. We want to look for mutational-based resistance and ensure that there aren't any drug interactions or problems with adherence, and think about alternative and to switch. So this is very good guidance, and again, it focuses in on adherence, drug interactions, mutational analysis, and what issues could be leading to less than optimal response. You know, advanced disease, I think we still have a fair bit of work to do. And just as a footnote, the World Health Organization has shifted our perspective, or it asked for a shift in perspective, that accelerated phase CML, historically progression or phased of progression, but of course it can be at presentation, really may be viewed differently. It could be biologically high-risk chronic phase CML based on certain factors, slow cytometric evidence of B lymphoblast, for example, certain clonal markers. So we need to pay attention to that as well. Advanced phase CML can clearly benefit from TKI therapy, but our approach has to be different. I think we've seen clear gains in the field of lymphoid advanced leukemia based on borrowing from work in ALL with immunotherapy, bispecific therapy, CAR T cell therapy, and we know that our induction regimens plus TKIs have really have evolved quite nicely. Myeloid blast phase disease, we have good data. For example, FLAG-IDA ponatinib is a very established regimen with a good response rate to bridge patients to transplant. But it would be nice if we were able to tackle this challenge a bit better. I'm reassured by the fact that we don't see it as often, but it's still a challenge. Again, just walking through the guidelines, we have pretty clear instructions about when patients fail imatinib or may fail now primary treatment with a new drug. We heard the question that we all have on our minds: what about sequencing after our newest and probably our best drug, asciminib, and the use of ATP competitive inhibitors afterwards? We have mutational based data to guide us. You know, it's not common to see that some of these mutations, for example, up front, but as Andreas mentioned, you know, you may see a patient with a myristoyl pocket mutation after asciminib therapy. It may be a small group of patients who fortunately have issue not responding to asciminib in the front line or who have resistance, but we need to be aware and to look. And the guidelines give us the roadmap, if you will, depending on which drug, which mutations should be avoided because of good in vitro data and clinical data as well. So in later line CML, we have fairly well established data with ponatinib. A very good drug, really tailored to become the first available agent in the space of BCR-ABL inhibition to effectively treat T315I mutated patients. The long analysis of the PACE trial, which looked at both T315I and non-T315I patients, now we can see very good data across cytogenetic response and molecular response and durability of major molecular response, which is extremely protective and safe for patients, and was was good across all groups, both patients with or without mutations, resistance and tolerance, and the T315I. So I think this is very comprehensive and solid data. It's rare in a responding patient, or rarer, to see progression. There obviously is some decline over time, but survival is quite good. It doesn't match the survival of the de novo treatment of CML, but it's extremely reassuring in highly resistant patients when they're treated well with a drug like ponatinib. When we dig deeper into some of the safety questions, which clearly were a hindrance for ponatinib, we saw steps where we had holds on the drug and adjudication of adverse events done. These are the data from the long-term report of this study, and you can see both lipase elevation and abdominal pain rise to the top of some of the grade 3-4 adverse events, as well as the cardiovascular issue of hypertension. Myelosuppression, as we talked about a moment ago, it was fairly prominent, thrombocytopenia, perhaps due to the heavily pretreated nature of these patients, their disease volume, but also potentially a therapy-related event. And on the right, the arterial occlusive events were reported. And it's not trivial, of course. There are a number of patients with different vascular beds, cerebrovascular, cardiovascular, and peripheral vascular, with serious adverse events. The rates of exposure, relative to exposure, are reported as well. This tends to be a fixed or an issue. It's not something that increases over time and tends to be a little bit less likely to be a venous event, but it's clearly something that requires careful monitoring of patients on therapy and probably having a good sense for their cardiovascular status at the time of a switch to ponatinib, so proper intervention in the cardiovascular space can be had. We now can step into a different space where we have another therapy which is active against the T315I, which hopefully can shed a lot of our concerns. So asciminib, as Dr. Hojas mentioned, is a STAMP inhibitor, which is subject to different mutations. The myristoyl pocket itself can have point mutations, much like point mutations in the ATP binding pocket, as you can see on the left, the comparative locations of these mutations. I mean, on one hand, asciminib may be agnostic to mutations in the ATP binding pocket in a general sense, but there are some mutations in the ATP pocket that can affect the binding of asciminib, and these newer mutations exist. The so-called spider plot on the right shows the difference, for example, between nilotinib and asciminib and some of the gaps. You know, we know that T315I is a clear resistant mutation for nilotinib, whereas asciminib is quite effective. And then if you look on the right, you see some of these novel mutations, such as A337V, and the mutations in the 460 region, which have some hindrance on the effectiveness of asciminib. So these are different drugs. The mutational analysis, again, to bring it home, is still central, and there is some overlap. What did we learn from study of asciminib in later line therapy? This is the ASCEMBL study, which you may be familiar with. It's been presented and published. A very good set of data for patients with two or more TKIs who had had failure, intolerance or resistance, had not had MMR, could not have a T315I or 299 mutation due to the randomization versus bosutinib. There was an allowance for patients to, on a separate analysis to be crossed over. And with longer follow-up, we now have very clear evidence that asciminib, both because we were more able to treat patients and because of greater efficacy, that it was superior. So looking at improvements in achievement of cytogenetic remission, BCR-ABL levels less than 1%, at 24, 96, and 156 weeks, you see the increasing gap, and asciminib really quite superior. The cumulative incidence, quite similarly, it looks quite good, and there's no catch-up, if you will. I think, again, the ability to have sustained high-quality treatment that is bringing patients into remission that's safe is the reason why asciminib was superior in this trial. Time to treatment failure, similarly, was quite different. The probabilities, as you can see on the right, and the median time to failing bosutinib for mixtures of both inadequacies of the drug to maybe manage the patient's resistance plus the inability to perhaps treat them led to this dramatic difference. the difference between adverse events over time is shown here. There isn't much difference if you look at 24, 96, and end of study, but the patterns are clearly different. One might have predicted, the GI toxicity profile for bosutinib was very prominent and persistent with both GI and transaminase events, whereas myelosuppression became a little bit of a lesser issue. It was a bit more prominent for asciminib early on and was the main difference there. So I think much more of a manageable adverse event profile. Of course, one of the most important things about adverse events is, does it lead to discontinuation? If you can manage it and work through it, it's different than, of course, if it ceases the ability of the patient to take the drug. And the difference here is quite striking. If you look at the number of patients who had treatment discontinuation based on adverse events, it's striking. And these are the adverse events which led to discontinuation. There's a different pattern, of course, and again, it's enriched for the GI toxicity and liver enzymes on the right, and myelosuppression and some other reasons on the left for asciminib. So getting to the focus of T315I-treated patients, what did we see in a subset of patients with chronic phase CML treated after at least one line of therapy? And this is data now coming from the phase 1 trial, which supported approval for asciminib for patients with T315I. So on the left is the patient profile. And you can see these are tough patients. They're patients who have generally had many lines of therapy. Not all had 3, 4, or 5 lines of therapy. Some patients can have T315I after just a single line of therapy. They generally have been exposed to many drugs. The majority of patients had, again, many lines of therapy. And notably, there were patients ponatinib-treated. So amongst the ponatinib-treated patients, we had both resistance and intolerance, but the majority for resistance. And then there is a possibility for more than one mutation, but this was, at least on the analysis, mainly a T315I-only population. So transcripts on the right, again, this was a phase 1 study, so patients could enter with some semblance of response, but the overwhelming majority had greater than 1% BCR-ABL levels. So in turn, the table, the figure on the lower right, shows you the ability to put patients into cytogenetic response equivalent, and you can see increasingly over time, with a greater ability to manage patients who hadn't had ponatinib exposure, but a very good ability to treat patients who had already had ponatinib exposure using asciminib. We look at MMR rates. I think the same story is shown, that there's a very high rate of ability to put patients into or preserve MMR. There's a bit of an advantage for patients who had not had ponatinib, but there's still a very good chance for patients who had ponatinib exposure, and also demonstrated on the figure on the right. So what else do we have in this space? Medications to look out for. So olverembatinib, if you're not familiar, is another ATP competitive agent, generally developed and so far generating data out of Asia, out of China. It's actually approved for patients in China, for patients with CML in chronic or accelerated phase with the T315I or multi-drug resistance. And we saw very good data from those studies, that it was well tolerated and efficacious. And now we have a data in a North American population with the demographics, as you can see, or non-Chinese patients, not North American, just a broader population, which I think is important. And again, the demographics. And a similar population, but now, you know, in a more current era, we have an even tougher scenario, perhaps, because now we have patients with, again, high transcripts, multiple lines of therapy, and now we have patients with prior ponatinib treatment, now at 50%, and about a quarter of patients with prior asciminib in this study. I think the data were quite encouraging. If you look at cytogenetic response, 55% in patients with a T315I mutation, and molecular response, 44%, and then so on down towards the right, you can see the responses in some of the other subgroups. And note that this is an every other day dosing, and some of the questions in this study were to look at the optimal dose, so we can see some of the differences between the doses. And this looks at, based on prior exposure, in prior ponatinib-exposed patients, cytogenetic response is 61 and molecular response is 46. And prior asciminib exposure, roughly a third of patients for cytogenetic and molecular response as well. So we're seeing that we can even sequence our later line therapies and have success, especially in this difficult population of the T315I mutation. Many people ask me, and maybe my colleagues as well, or you get asked, what about the safety of asciminib based on the differential dosing? We know that the dosing for patients with T315I is 200 milligrams twice daily versus 80 milligrams once daily, or 40 BID for non-T315I. And I think this is a time-dependent safety analysis on the left, which I think shows us that we don't see necessarily a greater proportion or persistence of toxicity with asciminib at higher doses. We see some of the same patterns. Some of the things that do occur maybe over a greater length of time can be lipase increase that does warrant continued monitoring, and constitutional symptoms like musculoskeletal pain and fatigue. But no real safety signal, if you will. Some of the same kind of patterns as you can look down the list on the right with regards to lipase increase, myelosuppression, thrombocytopenia. So lastly, two other drugs to be on the lookout for. Another ATP competitive drug, which is in early phase one trials, called Enliven-001, which was again developed to be perhaps a drug with a better adverse event profile, but active against T315I and other resistant mutant clones, is in study for chronic phase CML with a fairly broad entry criteria. Failure and tolerance are not a candidate for other therapies. A classic dose escalation study with plans to expand the relevant doses and to start to tackle the question about the need for different differential dosing or efficacy in the T315I population. We saw a press release just a few months ago showing that we had a very reasonable rate of MMR, which probably isn't exactly the right way to look at this data in a phase one study with heterogeneous input. I think more importantly, we see that patients evaluable for efficacy, they either had stable or improving responses, which is very encouraging. The safety of this drug, which isn't on this slide, I think, as you look at data as it emerges, is quite good with very limited adverse events and not the cardiovascular signal that we might have seen with ponatinib, perhaps not this early, but I think this is a very promising drug. And lastly, there are other drugs in development in the allosteric targeting area. So TERN-701 from company Terns is a second generation, if you will, or an alternate STAMP inhibitor, which is undergoing also phase one study, and you can see classic dose escalation. There is some data from a previous trial done in China, which supported some of the dose choices and some of the design of this trial, and there'll be further clarification of the dose as the data goes on. We just had a press release, there was a press release just a few days ago now, for the first 15 patients. Everyone wants very early data, and we can see that, again, a very difficult population, 60% of patients with higher than 1% transcripts, some T315I, and multiple lines of exposure. And we see, again, I think very encouraging early data, that we have most patients responding, including late salvage after even, say, five lines of therapy, and a very good toxicity profile with no DLTs or discontinuations or reductions for adverse events. So I think we're getting smarter with our later line agents. I think asciminib really is leading the way, but there are other drugs, you know, that which we need to look carefully at and hopefully can work into our armamentarium. So that's the end of my section.
Mike, may I ask a question?
Of course.
Yeah, thank you for this brilliant summary of all the options with now at least 9 drugs available. It's beautiful. But I think, what is a competitor to these 9 drugs? It's allogeneic stem cell transplantation. Who should be transplanted in 24, 25?
If I have other rules, Doug mentioned the Morrow rule, but we can't have a discussion about CML unless we at least acknowledge the fact that allogeneic transplant is highly successful. And it's true. I think maybe we should spend a minute on that. It may not be one of our questions, but I think many of our patients really seek non-transplant therapy, and they know that there are these many options available. And some of the difficulties are is that CML, even resistant disease, doesn't manifest physically and to patients. Yeah. So it's our job to adjudicate, you know, response and risk, and especially a young patient with a good donor without a protective remission who's on later line therapy. It needs to be discussed and advances in transplant, which I think we'll see hopefully a lot, you know, at this meeting or other ways to think about transplant. You know,
we have this European registry, EBMT registry, and it's seen that we transplant more patients in advanced disease than in chronic phase, which is a disadvantage. That means we need to select the individual patient who need the transplant earlier. And for me, I think cytogenetics, as I mentioned, is high-risk cytogenetic aberrations and recurrent cytopenias are very clear indications for transplant. You can do what you want. You can use any of the drugs. It will come up to cytopenia again or to evolution of the disease.
Following up on your comment, the EBMT earlier on had an analysis of when do you lose out if you maybe use ponatinib rather than transplant? And there's a good number of years you can, especially in chronic phase, but in advanced phase disease, transplant is a preferred option.
Yep.
And Doug, maybe you want to comment on this as well.
The data you showed, I think, are super helpful because you show the stability. When you achieve a deep response, for sure, a complete set of genetics, you see the stability of those on third generation TKIs, even after multiple. So if you're tolerating it well and you get to a deep response, you know, my sense is that those patients can do well for a very long time. They have to be followed closely because of multiple TKI resistance and because the option of a transplant exists for those patients. So you do want to watch them carefully. The other pressure that we're going to have to face is the fact that allogeneic transplant is going to be cheaper than treating patients for many, many, many years on very expensive TKIs. And so that has fallen into account in other countries throughout the world, and I think that's something that we're going to have to keep struggling with because of the success of transplant.
Yeah. It's a bit off topic, but I think the cost equation is clearly something that needs to be also front and center. I would hold out that if newer drugs increase our ability to cure patients and have successful TFR, the cost equation will look differently. I think some have published on the cost savings of treatment-free remission, but that data needs to be proven before we can say that.
And people have to become comfortable with treatment-free remissions. Yeah. And I think many people who treat lots and lots and lots of CML patients are comfortable with the idea of treatment-free remissions. We want that to happen for our patients. But there are folks out there that aren't as comfortable with the data, and there are patients out there who aren't comfortable with stopping as well. So there's work to do here.
So turning to the questions that we had generated, I think we touched on this. I think, Andreas, you mentioned the ASX01 data, which may answer question number one about biomarkers. And I think we'll see some data to give us some guidance. You know, I know in the U.S., our guidelines suggest sequencing, but we don't necessarily have the action to take. Other thoughts?
The question is right. It might predict. That's very, very soft, a very soft expression, because we may be able to improve the outcome of these patients, but we need a clue. We need to see which drugs could be combined at which stage, and then I think that's important. That means it's not a general resistance against all TKIs. It's just the way how to use them. Yeah, and that's, I think, the important response to that. With ASX1 data is too early. We have some data from our lab. We have data from Australia, from other labs, but we need a pattern on which treatment happens what.
And resolution of what's going to happen when these mutations discovered early on that can predict response or outcome maybe. And the question is, what happens when they go away? And what happens as our MRD testing gets better and we can understand persistence? And then we have to add in the different drugs and individualizing that responses in those settings. I urge, when possible, and the diagnosis is not 100% clear, and you're looking at somebody with a high count leukemia, it might be CML. I love and push our teams to send off sequencing just to try to gather those data. The more of that we can get, I think the better understanding we're going to have of this disease.
If not in clinical practice, at least in a research setting, it'd be tremendous to have this data. I'm going to throw a little bit of a curveball on, because we're getting some good questions from folks in the audience and online. And we may not be able to answer this unless you dabble in pediatrics. But what do you think about children? Because I know ASH is inclusive for hematology, and we have a lot of pediatric hematologists here. I think, what are our thoughts are on asciminib or, you know, younger patients and resistance or intolerance? Any top-line thoughts?
I don't see a major difference. I think CML in children is, in general, a little bit more aggressive than in adults. But in this context, of course, an early switch is important to optimize treatment. And therefore, all the drugs which you mentioned should be available in pediatric CML as well. And studies are ongoing.
The only difference I toss out in my practice and helping my pediatric colleagues with their patients is the idea of treatment-free remission is so important when you talk about a teenager or an eight-year-old kid or a 15-year-old kid newly diagnosed with CML. This idea, the goal of treatment-free remission might be very different compared to a 65, 70, 75-year-old newly diagnosed patients, because this is a lot of years of being on an agent. So tolerability is super important to make sure they take it. Getting a really good drug to give them the best chance of potentially getting a treatment-free remission in the future is magnified when you're talking about a young patient.
And to avoid gross retardation.
Yes.
And the best way to avoid gross retardation is to stop the drug.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think, please remember, 10 years ago, the pediatric guidelines showed demonstrated all patients should be transplanted. All pediatric patients. This has changed significantly.
Yeah.
And that's a major improvement now.
I think.
But the drugs should be used in a proper way, and therefore it's important to get data.
I think we take our sensitive population slower. Just a footnote, there was a liquid form of imatinib just recently developed, as many of you may know, which is terrific. I think a lot of adults could probably benefit from that. And I know the asciminib frontline studies in children, I know my colleagues in New York are championing some of those, so that's great. On this slide, maybe let's try to tackle the fourth question about the non-mutated patients. I shared a lot of data on T315I and the difference, and we sometimes view those as better patients who have an identified mutation. We mentioned ASXL1 and complex resistance. Any particular thoughts on choosing, you know, for example, ponatinib versus asciminib or other choices or these newer drugs?
Yeah, asciminib is currently at this dose which is needed, not available in Europe. Therefore, we have to use alternatives. We cannot prescribe 400 milligrams of asciminib for the time being. But we hope that the registration will be done in the next year for this situation as well. But we participate in the trials which you mentioned, Terns and Enliven have the option there. Ponatinib is the only registered drug for this mutation for the time being in many parts of the world, with all the concerns about ponatinib, of course.
Yeah. I'm particularly encouraged by maybe exploring dose escalation and, you know, the mid-range doses of asciminib for some of these patients.
I come back to my point on allotransplant. We should be fair here and should really consider transplant in these patients when nothing else is available. And ponatinib may be a bridge for the time being, but not forever.
We have a different roadmap for ponatinib now, and it's available, and we know how to use it better than we had in the past, with dose de-escalation, with responses, and trying to optimize and mitigate the side effects. So I think that is still a challenging space to be in.
Yeah. To give a nod to the audience, because these folks are here, someone brought a case for it. I'll use that maybe in lieu of the other one that's on the slide. So 69-year-old woman, now 6 years into treatment, never had an MMR and had prior exposure to the ATP competitive TKIs, who on 80 milligram asciminib has a A337 mutation.
So now which we have one? Which mutation?
A337T, so that myristoyl pocket mutation. So what do we think about that? And the past medical history is hypertension. So it's begging the question about the sequencing now in someone who's had previous exposure to the other TKIs.
Or combination.
Yeah.
Now, is MMR for this specific patient our treatment goal? I think not. It's too stringent. I think the 1% BCR-ABL, which is complete cytogenetic remission, is sufficient. And if this was achieved on the ATP competing drugs and asciminib produced a mutation, then I would go back to an ATP competing drug. There's no problem. That's a circle. And we should change over time our treatment aims. If I have shown in second and third and later lines, our goal should be less stringent. We want to avoid disease progression, and we can achieve this with a 1% BCR-ABL level.
Yeah, I tell everybody, don't forget, complete cytogenetic remission is very, very valuable. It's associated with survival benefits in almost every study that it's looked at. We MMR and MR4 and MR4.5, those are all wonderful goals. But when you start to talk second and third line therapy, known resistance, you know, a complete cytogenetic remission is a great goal to have if it's stable.
Yep.
So I like that idea.
So if I can indulge myself, that's the cake, and then MMR is the icing, and then the cherry on top is the TFR, right? In the interest of time, one more question from our audience. We talked a bit about lipase elevation with all of our therapies in the front line and with all TKIs and now in later line. What do we do for the patient who had pancreatitis on, say, nilotinib? How do we move forward nowadays, knowing that all the drugs have this risk?
It's a dose issue, probably, the pancreatitis, and therefore we should choose a drug which can be dose reduced, and most data are now available for dasatinib. I think dasatinib low dose could be an option here. Definitely not imatinib here. And for ponatinib, we have, of course, the OPTIC trial with the lower dose as well. But for other reasons, I would choose low-dose dasatinib here.
Yeah, I think response has to play a role in it, too. Like, how well are they doing on the current dose? And if somebody's in a deep response or a MMR, you know, I think you can almost try a different, you have to try a different drug if they're symptomatic, and I think the dasatinib makes great sense, and it can be low dose, and you hope that they'll tolerate that one better. There are people, like with thrombocytopenia, that multiple TKIs all result in symptomatic pancreatitis, and again, it falls into a group that we end up taking some of those, one patient every year, one patient every other year, pancreatitis driven, that we take the transplant because they cannot really tolerate any other TKI.
I just want to remind you that pancreatitis was very rare in ASCEMBL and also in the Ask for First trial. Lipase elevation was frequent.
Yes.
And therefore I would like to do a survey of all of you here after Christmas. Just test your lipase after Christmas. And I'm sure that more than 10% have a lipase elevation after that. That means it's quite normal.
Yeah. You, research to practice will gather the data. You have your marching orders right after your Christmas dinner or your holiday dinner for other holidays being celebrated. Check your lipase. In the interest of time, I want to hand the podium over to Dr. Smith to bring us home to talk about tolerability and practical issues. Thanks.
Thanks, everybody, and thanks for the good questions from the audience. Very helpful. So we're going to talk about a little bit of tolerability and maybe some practical keys and insights to the treatment. Oral medications, oral chemotherapy, oral oncolytics, super important growth over the last 60-some-odd years, and I've circled in 2001 the approval of Gleevec, imatinib, at the time. Now, we've had oral cytotoxics and oral hormonal therapies, but targeted therapies really has transformed the practice of cancer, if you will. And again, my version of what's the treatment landscape look like with six drugs out there, FDA approved, and five of them available in the upfront, and I think of them as first and second and third generations, as you can see here. But, and there are certainly some important promises that are offered by oral oncolytics, if you will. And that is, this is how we can be precise, and this is how we can offer personalization of medicine, because each of these six drugs has a different profile in many, many ways. And there's a lot of benefits, you know. The problem is you have to be careful, because this idea of taking an oral drug, is it, you know, safety is sort of presumed, if you will, and we send people out with a month of these prescriptions, and sometimes they're not scheduled to come back and see us as frequently as they need to be. And we have to remember that compliance is super important when you have oral agents. Giving somebody a slug of IV or sub-Q medication, you know, we know they get it. For the most part, the oral drug compliance is important. The promise of compliance is here, and that is patients with response look to have near a similar life expectancy to age-matched controls, and this is data that were published a few years ago from the Swedish registry data. So when you look at someone that has a responsive CML, they do really, really well long-term. And so promise of an oral agent and efficacy is super important. The pitfalls are that this idea that it's simple, and that you can trust patients, and we know how people do with 2 weeks of antibiotics and how often they complete their full course of antibiotics. Think about the rest of your life on an oral drug, some of them twice a day. So you have to really think about compliance as a super important part of this. People that are on oral drugs long-term, we have to realize that the complications we get into late tend to be related to other drugs. So there are other medical comorbidities come into play, and treating of those sometimes impacts how our agents are working. Dr. Holkhaus has mentioned this multiple times. These are just data that were 10 years old now, but it's this notion that even on frontline imatinib, a significant number of people have long-term complications. These aren't complications that make you stop the drug. These are complications and annoyances that they have every day. And when you look at, 80% of patients may have, complications of, muscle cramping or a sense of fatigue or swelling of some part. So we cannot forget that long-term side effect profiles of these drugs are really, really important. So I'm going to walk you through some data that I think helped begin to distinguish the different TKIs from each other from a side effect profile. I've done my best to rely on 5-year follow-up data when those were available. So when I show you some of the graphs and charts, it tends to be from the 5-year data. And remember, all of the drugs that sort of went on to become frontline therapy were compared to imatinib up front. So that's one of the pathways that they got to their approval as an upfront therapy, is they ended up squaring off with imatinib at some point. And so a lot of comparators will be based on those data. Number one, when you're starting someone on therapy, there are some common, very basic side effects that you have to think about: myelosuppression, LFT, and transaminitis. Electrolyte abnormalities can happen early on, and this global problem of fatigue and people just not feeling as well as they would like to feel. So because of this kind of profile early on, I'm a strong believer that you have to follow people relatively closely early on for blood counts and monitoring for cytopenias. There will be a group of patients, higher risk patients, big spleen patients, patients with abnormal blood counts that tend to have significant cytopenias, and you have to follow them carefully throughout until they nadir. Liver function was a problem early on. We sort of now understand it, and we're very cautious of liver agents that also might impact the liver, but you need to watch them every couple of weeks. Again, typically for the first month or so, electrolytes as well, and then cardiovascular. As we pick TKIs, we have to think about cardiovascular risk, certainly, and we have to understand the early impact. Getting EKGs makes some sense early on. I don't think we need to do that long term, other than the fact that people come and go on different drugs that may affect QTC and other factors. So again, when we look at the frontline therapy of imatinib, it tends to be a drug I think about that has some sort of qualities, if you will, some GI intolerabilities, some cramping or muscle cramping. Peripheral edema can be part of the early on problem. And again, I show you this slide again from 5-year data from the IRIS study to simply say two things: that early on you can expect some cytopenias from these things and some liver abnormalities, like I mentioned. Following people carefully is super important. When you see these events later, so the last column here is what's the onset of trouble with cytopenias or liver after 4 years of being on the drug? Super low. If you're seeing something late, it is unlikely to be the drug. It may be something different, change in the patient's condition, a change in their medical profile. So late side effects, you need to think about them slightly differently when you're talking about these TKIs. Nilotinib, right? So one of the second generation TKIs. This is a drug that has some certainly impact, has a little bit of dysrhythmia. It's got the black box warning, but really the impact on hypertension and glucose control tends to be ones that concern me often the most, and obviously this translates to cardiovascular risk. I'll show you this. These are data from the ANEST study, and this is again imatinib versus nilotinib at two different doses, and we can see things like the emergence of amylase and lipase being active here, sugar control being a little more challenging on nilotinib. And again, when we look at some things like rash and headache and pruritus, alopecia, again, these are side effects that we see emerge as we a little bit more as we move into second generation TKIs. Dasatinib, everyone here will understand the idea of effusions here, this rare complication of pulmonary arterial hypertension and some impacts on platelet function and bleeding. But again, looking at the five-year decision, this is dasatinib versus imatinib up front. The effusion are way off the chart as far as the fact that dasatinib is, these are much, much more common in dasatinib. There are strategies emerging. Dosing strategies and continuous days of therapy strategy, 5 instead of 7, that may impact the success of these. And I pulled out the facial edema, the muscle spasms, the nausea, and the vomiting. Again, these all seem to be more related to imatinib toxicity. So again, you're getting a theme that imatinib has some sort of toxicities. Each of these TKIs might have something slightly different. Bosutinib, GI toxicity. Everybody understands this drug almost didn't make it to approval because of inability for early studies for patients to tolerate it until we understood the drug a little bit better. And again, when you're looking at bosutinib versus imatinib, the 5-year follow-up data, significant difference in GI toxicity, both liver and diarrhea, very important to be aware of. Again, I'm back to the facial edema. Imatinib, very common, very something you can almost expect to see in your patients if you use the first-generation drug. How about ponatinib? Well, again, our whole understanding of TKIs and CML changed with the early understanding of the cardiovascular risks. Ponatinib doesn't have a strong hold on cardiovascular risks here, but certainly it came to light. We've looked back at all the TKIs, and there's certainly some cardiovascular risk associated with these, and we just have to be aware of them. Michael showed these data as well, and I'm just pointing out that the cardiovascular events are both arterial and venous. And over time, it looks like these remain relatively stable. They don't seem to increase in lot over time. And the final thing you have to understand is it's interesting to me that the arterial events are a little bit more common than the venous events over time. So what's super important is to help manage and be aware of this so that patients optimize their cardiovascular health. Tobacco and sugar control and hypertension control, all these things are certainly very important for our patients that are treated with ponatinib, especially full dose of 45 milligrams daily. And the asciminib data, we've seen some slides already from both of our previous presenters. Again, we're learning and we need longer and longer term data for asciminib. But I don't expect you guys to really completely read this. I know this is overwhelming, but this is from the paper that was just published with our first author to my right. But again, I want to point out a couple of things that, you know, asciminib, when you're talking about just adverse events compared to a second generation TKI, is very favorable, and very favorable compared to the first generation imatinib. These are just basically grade 3 and grade 4 events, fewer versus imatinib, fewer versus second-generation TKIs. And when we look at thrombocytopenia, which was interesting to me, and anemia and low counts seem to be a little bit less second-generation and first-generation compared to asciminib did better. And finally, when we look at the liver, the complications, AST, ALT, again, very favorable profile for a third generation, the stamp inhibitor, asciminib. So each of these TKIs tends to have a slightly unique profile. There's common side effects from all of them, but I think this is very, very important to understand that there's some that have GI toxicity, some that have cardiovascular risks, some which might be a little bit more related to fluid accumulation like effusions, and you have to understand that if you're going to be successful at personalizing these medicines. So again, the promises of oral TKIs and oral oncolytics across the board is that it's possible using side effect profile, patients' comorbidities, to personalize our approach to our treatments. You have to be comfortable with it. One of the challenges, I think, for people in practice that are comfortable with one or two of the TKIs compared to a CML person who may be comfortable with all 6 of them is to getting to understand, to know the profiles so that you can help pick the right drug for your patients if it's a tolerability issue. And again, I've listed here just for reference some ways we think about these things very broadly, side effect profiles that are kind of unique to each of these drugs, and maybe this will help people think about how to use them in the future. And with that, I'll thank you for your attention, and I will turn it back over to Michael.
Well, thank you. Okay. You guys are terrific for questions, by the way. Just getting flooded up here. Let me just jump in with a few questions that we're getting from folks here. And nephrotic syndrome and dasatinib. Reduced dose? Is that an intolerance? Where do we go with that?
I have a patient who's actively, we're actively working through this problem right now. She's actually early 60s, and this sort of came out of the blue. I didn't believe it at first, and I sort of said, hey, listen, we really want your kidney doctor to weigh in here to figure about this nephrotic syndrome, but it was real. And I moved her to a different drug compared to dose adjustment because I wasn't exactly sure what to do. So I'm looking for help, and I'll turn to you, Andres, for your thoughts.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I was just reading the questions.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
We were talking about nephrotic syndrome and dasatinib and whether dose reduction is good enough to avoid it.
Nope. The five-day regimen.
Okay. This is a good point for us. Dasatinib is a multi-kinase inhibitor, and we expect that the pleural effusions are based on the alternative inhibition of, we don't know which kinases, but on other kinases. And therefore, our idea was, since dasatinib has this very short half-life, to get a break, to induce a break over the weekend. That means 2 days off to avoid this continuous accumulation of pleural effusions. Yeah. It has worked.
Yeah.
This worked. We have reduced the incidence of pleural effusions by 50%. And that's the answer, I think. Of course, alternative options are to reduce the dose in general, which is possible with dasatinib, because it has this very wide therapeutic window in contrast to others. That means the notion that we can halving the dose for everybody in all kinases is probably not right. It depends on the specific inhibitor.
So the question, but let me extend that. So dose reduction, we know there's been some studies in effusions. How about this nefarious nephrotic syndrome, this kidney problem that has been reported now with the dasatinib? And I don't know that it's necessarily going to be something that gets better with a break.
Yeah,
it's a problem of the biology of this. If it's dose related, then of course the dose reduction is useful. But I'm not sure if it's dose related. Yeah. I think the change of the drug here is important.
We may have different categories. I think we might have sort of inflammatory drive that you can mitigate with dose reduction and gaps with maybe later pleural effusions. You may have immune mediated mechanisms like nephrotic syndrome, which once triggered may not be reversible with a drug holiday or a lower dose. Yeah. So I think that was a very, thank you both. I think a very good question. Let's just turn to the second question here on the screen, which I think it's pretty straightforward, but we haven't really spoken about TFR. Mm. That's not what the question says, but have a look at it. It's a 64-year-old man who's on frontline dasatinib, all milestones met, DMR by 12 months, and a sustained MR4 for over 2 years. Now, I might ask the question about the U.S. versus Europe, because we have an international panel here. Do we think this patient is okay to take a treatment break? I love the way that's phrased.
I would ask the lab for MR4.5. The lab should be able to be so sensitive to demonstrate MR4.5 because we know that this is a better option for this continue. This guy is doing very, very well, and we should continue treatment until we have stable MR4.5. I think that's the better option than to discontinue after 3 years. 3 years is a very short period. I would prolong treatment here to consolidate the response a little bit more, 4 or 5 years, but to demonstrate MR4.5 is in Europe very important.
I think two questions I think worth thinking about, and I talk to people about this frequently, is number one is why? Why does this person want a break? Is it as a low-grade side effect that we've heard about from all these drugs? Is there something, or is it just annoyance? Is it cost? What is the problem in the 64? Yeah. Why does he want to stop? And the second thing is, this might be the person that I'd say, if it's a low-grade side effect or there's something going on, I might say, hey, why don't we change your dose? Why don't we lower your dose? You're at a four, you're at least an MR4. We want MR4.5 before stopping. At least I do. I tend to agree with that. And the notion is that I think that it's possible that this will continue to have a very deep response on a lower dose that might address if it's a side effect issue.
I have exactly the same approach. Three things: side effects you need to get rid of, side effects you're trying to avoid, or you just are very motivated and you wish to stop. So I think that was a great answer. Doug, I might ask you this question because I know you have some history in this space. Is there any role for interferon? I know your career, you and your center as well. Cross intolerance to multiple TKIs, maybe in pregnancy. This is sort of a niche question. But.
Yeah. So you've mentioned two of them. I have a 3 or 4 patients currently that are on interferon, and two of them are on because of pregnancy. And I chose to use pegylated interferon as the patient's PCR came up when they stopped their TKI over time because of being pregnant. I also have had a couple of patients whom had profound cytopenias and multiple TKIs. They did not want to go to transplant, and we'd sort of talked about that notion. And I said, listen, I'm going to give you 6 to 12 or 15 months, see how you tolerate interferon, and see what your PCR does over time. And you have to be patient, but there are 10 or 15% of patients where interferon tends to be a really good drug for. They get into deep molecular responses, and it can be very effective for them. And with pegylated options for weekly dosing, they tend to be relatively well tolerated compared to daily interferon in the day. Yeah. So interferon still is an interesting and active drug, but that's how I've been using it currently.
The problem is, at least in Europe, the problem is not available anymore. Yeah. That means the companies lost interest in pegylated formulations of interferon because it was not needed in hepatitis anymore, because we have better drugs in hepatitis now. Right. And they changed the processing of interferon. It was out-licensed to smaller companies, and now it's over. It's not available. The only thing which is available in Europe is Besremi, the Ropec interferon, the expensive Ropec interferon licensed for PV, but not for CML. We may get it agreed from the insurance company to be paid in pregnancy or so. But we have a real problem here for the maintenance of interferon-treated patients. I have also a few interferon patients on interferon maintenance every other week, every 3 weeks, a very low dose, very well tolerated, very stable. They need to discontinue now.
Andreas, any final comments? Because you've studied this as well extensively in combination and sequencing.
We did this study. I showed in my first slide, I showed the survival of the Tiger trial. But of course, the main question was whether a combination of nilotinib with interferon has an advantage for TFR. It has a minor advantage in some patients, but it's of course a selection process. When you start with a combination, then you do the maintenance with interferon alone, then you select the patients at risk first, and then of course the overall result is better, but overall it does not show a major advantage, and therefore I see the indication for interferon in CML only in pregnancy.
Immunotherapy has to be important in CML based on allogeneic transplant data. We don't have the right immunotherapy drugs yet. But that will be the next question. I think that's the next 10 years as we get these other cool drugs that are coming. T315 activity are very prominent in these drugs. Tolerability is getting better. Question is, when we have myeloid-based immunotherapies, how are we going to integrate them? Because that could help.
Don't forget the TFR patients are our best patients. They had the best responses and the best tolerability. Do we want to get a risk here with inducing immune therapy side effects here. Checkpoint inhibitors have been used in CML. Yeah. Was a disaster.
Yeah.
For the time being.
With a lot of side effects. We have to get the right ones and see whether or not for the people that are resistant and the toughest to treat and the cytopenias and the pancreatitis, are those people that might be somehow benefited by some sort of immune therapy based stuff like an interferon might have been.
I want you guys both to think about question number one, but I'm going to ask other questions first because we're going to close with that point. But we had two great questions about transplant coming from Zoom and in person. And one is about the disease status going into transplant. Do we transplant patients with hematologic relapse or molecular, you know, when is it, is there an optimal point? And also post-transplant TKI use, any comments on that?
Now, post-transplant TKI depends on the disease stage prior to transplant. If it was blast crisis and we were able to rescue this patient, then we should think about a maintenance treatment after. But if it was chronic phase and we transplanted and we have a negative PCR with a sensitivity of 4.5 logs, of course, afterwards, then we don't need an maintenance, in my opinion, because with any drug, we may induce resistance as well in the person. We may have persistent CML cells in this, but they are covered by the GBL effect. And that means all the TKIs are a little bit immunosuppressive. That means we give an immunosuppressive drug, we may induce resistance. Therefore, I think no drug is better, at least in the chronic phase, with zero PCR.
We practice in a similar way. High risk going in with blast crisis now in chronic phase, we would give them a TKI following. I don't know how long to keep that going. At least do 5 years, but if they're tolerating it well. Chronic phase, we try to transplant before they're in a hematologic failure. So we cytogenetics, we understand they're going to be positive. The TKIs aren't working for patients. We'll try to transplant them, but we'd like to do it while their blood counts are relatively stable on whatever medicine they're showing resistance for.
Yeah. No, we need to acknowledge the kinetics of transcripts in post-transplant and chronic phase. People can take some time to go into full remission. I think one of the toughest questions is which TKI do you use? Because we don't have study of all of them, and we have some questions about the effect.
Depends on the situation prior to transplant, which mutation was there.
All right.
Yeah.
So now to question number one. I think this might be a good place to stop. It's fairly, maybe fairly obvious, but which approved TKI has the most favorable tolerability profile in frontline?
With approved, you mean FDA approved.
Yeah. I keep asking you, Andreas, and you're like, but what about the EMA?
What about Europe? What about Europe?
Of course, for the FDA approval, I think the answer is quite obvious after all our data which we presented. Then asciminib is the drug of choice, of course, for first-line treatment. But we need to convince the EMA.
I was a little surprised that it was as the data were as strong as they were, actually. I wasn't quite ready. I knew the effectiveness was going to be there. I felt strongly that that would be good. I didn't realize that the efficacy or the safety profile seemed to be really favorable. I do want longer-term follow-up for asciminib as well. It's the one we sort of have the least amount of long-term data, but a very favorable, I agree.
But don't forget, we have the 10-year experience of the phase one.
Yeah.
This was the longest phase one trial in my life, which I participated
same
in.
Here.
Yeah.
Same
we
here.
Have 10-year follow-up here. Yeah. That means we have very, very good experience on long-term side effects. Yeah.
I echo that if you have questions about safety, look at the phase one data's long-term follow-up. Mark. And I encourage everyone to look for more data from asciminib at the meeting and other drugs as well. But I want to thank you, everyone, for attending. Thank you very much. Enjoy ASH.
You.